This Civic Media podcast is sponsored by UW Organ and Tissue Donation. Organ donations are desperately needed, and now is the right time to become an organ donor. Talk to your family. Get the dot. Save lives. Go to heroicdeed.com.
Broadcasting across the state of Wisconsin on the Civic Media Radio Network and around the world on the Civic Media app, this is the Dom Salvia Show. And now, here's your host, Dom Salvia.
And welcome to the Dom Salvia Show. Thank you so much for listening. You can be a part, as always, 855-752-4842. Got Jess P.S. on the board and jazzed as hell because it's Tuesday. That means it's overtime with Maggie Dawn, her fine program right here, preceding my 2 to 4 p.m. on the Civic Media Radio Network. Hey, Maggie, what's going on?
Nothing happening.
Nope, just another
very
day in paradise.
Very boring news day, yes.
God, it's cold outside, huh?
Yeah, very cold.
And it's sunny.
It's sunny and cold.
Yeah, and the Packers lost. No, we're not talking sports, and we're not talking weather. We're talking the real deal. We're talking about the politics and a lot to get to. I know you were talking about Pete Hegseth. We will address that later on in the show as well. But, Maggie Dawn, that fine legal mind of yours, I wanted to discuss some of my findings in Jack Smith's report.
Yes.
And I actually read a little bit of it. No, I didn't print it out. I see you wasted some trees there, Maggie. But
all lawyers, we like the hard copy.
You gotta have it. Well, at least you can highlight it and have it in front of you. If you lose your computer screen, then it's all over.
Curtains.
Love the reporting. Washington Post, 6 takeaways from the Jack Smith article. New York Times, 4 takeaways.
That's it, guys.
We got 10 takeaways, and a couple of them overlap. But the one that got me, Maggie Dawn, if you'll indulge me momentarily.
Certainly.
Prosecutors considered charging Trump with inciting insurrection, but didn't. A few paragraphs from the Washington Post. When the election interference indictment was first unsealed in 2023, Smith's team received criticism from some quarters, that'd be me and perhaps others, for not charging Trump with incitement to insurrection, a crime that could have prevented him from again seeking elected office had he been convicted. Now, in his report, Smith revealed that he and his team had considered pursuing such a charge and believed they had amassed some evidence to support it. They ultimately chose not to, however, deeming such prosecution too risky and believing the other charges they had lodged against Trump to be sufficient. The insurrection statute, which dates to the period before the after the Civil War, had not been used to prosecute anyone in more than 100 years and was untested in modern criminal courts, the report said. Prosecutors would also have to rely on a novel interpretation of the law that matched their accusations against Trump. So, and then the Washington Post goes on to quote here, but I will go to the source document for you folks reading along at home. It's page 64 of the final report of the special counsel's investigations and prosecutions. Now, that's the actual page. It's actually the PDF. It's page 72. And here is just a little bit of it from the source. Case laws interpreting insurrection in other contexts, one court observed that an insurrection typically involves overthrowing a sitting government rather than maintaining power, which could pose another challenge to proving beyond a reasonable doubt that Trump's conduct on January 6th qualified as insurrection, given that he was sitting president at the time. And they quote lots of sources. I'm just going to scroll down to the next page where they continue the report. The office did not find any case in which a criminal defendant was charged with insurrection for acting within the government to maintain power as opposed to overthrowing it or thwarting it from the outside. Applying Section 2383 in this way would have been a first, which further weighted against charging it given other available charges, even if it were reasonable arguments, if there were reasonable arguments that it might apply. Maggie, if I'm reading this, it seems like, there seems to be evidence of insurrection. You could have charged this thing. They had other things against it. And I guess I understand weighing the evidence and trying to get the conviction. Go a little bit lower, you get more of a possibility of conviction. But the fact that it hasn't been done in over 100 years, to me, is not a reason not to charge, because that's what the guy did. I have a huge, huge problem with this, because it was insurrection and he was there. What is your legal thought on Jack Smith deciding to go after these other charges, which are perhaps.
Very serious.
And easier to prove, I guess, than the one that hasn't been used in over 100 years.
There's an old saying, if you shoot at the king, don't miss. And in this kind of a criminal prosecution, I don't necessarily agree with it. I don't have all of the evidence that Jack Smith had. But I can tell you what my personal view is when it comes to government actor defendants, okay? Whether you're talking about people who have abused campaign finance law, either locally, state office, or nationally. When prosecutors don't charge charges against current or former public officials, especially when there is evidence that supports the charge, what they are doing is depriving the American public through the jury system of the right to hold former or current government officials to the highest standards, right? If you don't charge it, they're not being pressed in that way. The jury isn't going to see the evidence right. that may permit a jury, not every jury, to consider whether or not they did this most egregious of things, right? And when it comes to government actor, especially the high-level officials, when you don't charge those things, I think it's... In general, again, I haven't seen the evidence sure. that Jack Smith, yeah. it's really hard to speak about it. And Jack Smith is not a shrinking violet prosecutor by any stretch, sure. right? But as distinguishable from lay civilians, you take lay civilians and oh, gee whiz, they'll throw every conceivable freaking charge.
Right, and try to get you to plead out to something.
They'll extort a plea. Yes. We call yes. it pleading. Some people call it extortion. But when it comes to the most powerful, all of a sudden, it seems to be a different calculus. And I understand that the stakes are high. And I understand that my first statement, if you're going to shoot at the king, don't miss, seems to be contrary to, yep, there are complicated, I think, contrarian ideas here. I think that Jack Smith's very deliberate, plotting thinking, as laid out in this report about that, shows that this wasn't a guy just throwing everything that he might think might stick on the wall at it. He looked at what he thought he could prove. And I'm gonna pivot to this other element that we see sometimes in prosecutions. If it's someone who's really powerful or really rich, all of a sudden it's like, well, I have to be sure that I can prove this totally beyond a reasonable doubt. And I'm assured of conviction when the people have means. When it's people that don't have means right. and don't have power, then it's charge them with everything under the sun and extort the plea. You want to know about why there are two systems? It's not about liberals and progressives and conservatives and MAGA. That's not the difference. The difference is, do you have a pile of money or a pile of influence or both? And if you do, all of a sudden it's going to be, well, I got to be absolutely certain I can prove every charge beyond a reasonable doubt. And if I can't, I'm not charging. If you're poor or you don't have power, you don't have that kind of grist for the mill, you don't have that kind of juice, then it's, I'll throw every conceivable charge at you. And the reason that this tends to be the case, whether we're talking about state prosecutions or feds, unfortunately, is that that's the way the incentive structures are set up for prosecutors, right? You don't get promoted when you charge and lose.
Right.
Right.
Talks you don't about get their percentage of convictions.
Yeah. You don't get to be a district attorney and then run for AG and then win and then maybe run for governor or Supreme Court and win if you charge and lose. And the odds of you losing when you charge are higher when the person's got a pile of money, a pile of access, and a pile of power. But your odds of winning are way up there, or extracting that plea when the poor person doesn't have money, influence, and power. That is the two-tiered system of justice in this country, and it has nothing to do with whether or not you're a Republican and Democrat, and that's why it should matter to every single one of us regular people.
Folks, that is Maggie Dawn. This is Overtime with Maggie Dawn. She precedes this show. Check her out 2 to 4 p.m. Monday through Friday on the Civic Media Radio Network. Love it when you spend a little time with us, Maggie. Thank you for doing so. The other thing, what concerns me about this lack of charge, again, from the report, Jack Smith, the office, did not find any case in which a criminal defendant was charged with insurrection for acting within the government to maintain power as opposed to overthrowing it or thwarting it from the outside. So this has never happened before. Yeah, no doubt. Of course it hasn't happened before. We've never had...
because George Washington said it shouldn't be so.
It should. Well, the first time we've not had a peaceful transfer of power. I mean, this is...
Other than that one time way long ago. There was a little kerfuffle.
In modern times.
Yes, there you go.
Okay, fair enough. In the last 100 years, we'll go there. Because they haven't used this insurrection law in 100 years. Well, this has never happened. No one's ever done it from the inside before. Well, if you don't go after the crime from the inside, what's the next president get to do? What's he get to do this time? He wasn't prosecuted for it. Why wouldn't he do it again?
Yeah, I think the deterrent or lack thereof impact of charging decisions is a real, real
thing. Especially with a guy like Donald Trump.
Absolutely. I'm also going to make this observation about lawyers writ large. This is me sort of taking the micro question and talking about the macro, which I hope you don't mind.
Sure.
I have great respect for the vast amount of lawyers out there. But I will say this. Lawyers are not trained to be creative thinkers. Okay? Hmm. We are trained to have a zero risk tolerance. We are trained to see the world in zero sum. We are trained to see everything as... you know, again, combat, and we are trained to color in the lines, right? If there's not precedent, it's not a thing. Well, guess what? When unprecedented things happen, precedent isn't a good rubric or ruler by which to adjudge or determine what comes next.
Nothing's a precedent until it becomes a precedent.
Correct. And it is this kind of, and I don't mean this to besmirch my fellow professionals, but there is this moment where all of this stuff is happening. And if you keep, and it's Democratic politicians too, you keep thinking that we got to be in the box and we can't create new law or think about this differently or take a different tack or approach or argument, you're losing because the other side's making up the new stuff. And they're not bound by the norms and institutional principles. They make it up. You got to start coloring outside the lines, folks, from Democratic politicians to the ones that run our parties to the lawyers that represent us.
Folks, you're listening to the Dom Salvia Show. It is Overtime with Maggie Dawn. Come back with us, 855-752-4842. Want to talk a little bit about Pete Hegseth with Maggie. Stick around.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
And welcome back to the Dom Salvia Show, 855-752-4842. Harvey K., Professor Emeritus of Democracy at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay, joins me this hour. You can do so as well, 855-75-CIVIC. Kind of lamenting this conviction of Donald Trump getting away with it. And whatever benefit he garnered, Harvey, from cutting those checks and posting things incorrectly and the benefit he received from that activity, there's been no consequence to it. And I guess this is kind of an ongoing story, man. It seems like, you know, the history continues to repeat itself with the rich and the powerful and the connected taking advantage of those positions and basically working the rest of us over, living by rules that, you know, not living by the rules that we have to live with. And with your affinity for FDR, can you give me a snapshot into the mindset, perhaps, of what the people, what the citizens were thinking. How did a guy like FDR connect to bring people together? Because I got to tell you, man, I believe these kinds of things would not happen if we felt like we had a sense of urgency, if we have a sense that if we band together, we could make changes. I just feel like back in those days, it seemed a little more unified, at least on the citizen level, not us v them, but certainly concerned about the power of the rich and connected.
You know, I'll tell everyone, this was not a setup question. I didn't know that you were going to ask me that question.
Nor did I, man. It's just radio.
but just before we came on, just before I entered the studio by way of the StreamYard, I decided I was going to post something about the gross inequalities and FDR's view of the imperative of containing the power, at least of the economic elite. And then I'll come back to the question in the more general sense. He said, this was in 1935, he said, social unrest and a deepening sense of unfairness are dangers to our national life, which we must minimize by rigorous methods. People know that vast personal incomes come not only through the effort or ability or luck of those who receive them, but also because of the opportunities for advantage which government itself contributes. Therefore, the duty rests upon the government to restrict such incomes by very high taxes. Now, he called for high taxes on the rich, not only because they needed, as he saw, they needed the taxes to pursue the programs he had in mind. He believed that the gross inequalities in income literally empowered these folks to become economic royalists. And if they become economic royalists, democracy itself is severely threatened. And I do want to say that if people have a look at some of the works I've been pursuing these last many years, one of the things I discovered in writing those is that FDR, in many ways, actually campaigned against the Gilded Age, against this privileged elite. In fact, he was called by many of them a traitor to his class because he came from the elite. But he was determined, he really was, to limit the incomes and wealth of the wealthy for the sake, not only, as I said, of the New Deal, but for the sake of democracy. And whether it was during the 30s, Great Depression, or later during the war years, he sought ways to enact or get Congress to enact laws limiting how much wealth could be accumulated, because he saw that as coming at the expense of working people. Now, I would also add that the FDR administration, all 12 years of it, and this I picked up from other historians as I entered into the work, was probably, despite the vast scale of government activity, the least corrupt administration ever in American history up to that point. Okay, So I mean, FDR's view of corruption was you go after it and you find folks who you can trust to occupy positions in your cabinet who are not out, you know, to fill their own bank accounts. Or like in the case of somebody who I won't bother to name, everyone will know. Okay, you don't seek to cut billions from the federal budget in order to enhance your $350 billion of wealth.
Well, if you can't use your money to get yourself some more money, what's the point of the money? Harvey, I give it all away for just a little bit more. Harvey K., Professor Emeritus of Democracy from the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. Okay, Harvey. So then where did that go wrong? Was it Reagan? At what point did, because it seems like people were buying into it. The guy got elected, right? The tax rates were high. We didn't have quite the disparity we do now. It's seemingly, to my opinion, I think the facts would probably bear that out. And now we see, you see Bezos and you see Elon Musk. You see these folks flexing their wealth, power, man. They're using it. They're using it to shape opinion. They're using it to shape legislation. They're shaping governments. I mean, Musk is over, you know, once he got done with the election here, he starts, you know, poking his nose into Europe, man. This guy continues to go. So at what point do you think we went from this thought of FDR to use these policies to limit the wealth and the corruption that would come from that? Where did that go wrong, man?
Okay, it began, and I hate to speak, once upon a time it was easy to speak of this guy because he was alive and he just passed away recently. It began in the latter half of the Carter years, Carter sought to empower business. He wanted to liberate business from the constraints of the FDR and Lyndon Johnson years. But it was during the Reagan administration when we saw, I mean, throughout the 1970s, the wealthy basically contributed to initiatives that would attack the idea of government itself, calling it big government, attack unions, calling it big unions. I mean, they wanted to reduce the pressure upon themselves to pay the taxes that might be fair. Don't forget it. The highest tax rate ever on the rich was instituted in the Eisenhower years, you know? So anyhow, yes, during the Reagan years. But the point is, it continued. Whether it was a Republican or a Democrat, the practice continued of letting the rich get richer and richer while working people, ever since the early 70s, hardly saw any increase in their incomes and standard of living.
It is. It's terrible. Harvey K., Professor Emeritus of Democracy, you can stick around for the remainder of the hour. Pew Research, Harvey, from January 9th, 2025, economic inequality seen as major challenge around the world. Most say rich people's political influence is a big contributing factor. We're going to come back and talk about this with Harvey K. plus some of your calls, 855-752-4842.
You're an organ donor, right? Well, here's a tragic fact. Approximately 20 people die each day waiting for precious donated organs. You could make a life-saving decision simply by getting that important dot on your driver's license. That little dot shows those who need to know that you've made a decision to donate organs at a critical time. Go to heroicdeed.com to learn more about the importance of organ donation and how you can make your wishes known. Talk to your family. Get the dot. Save lives. HeroicDeed.com.
Welcome back to the Dom Salvia Show. Thank you for being a part. You can join us, 855-752-4842, 855-75-CIVIC. Got Jess P.S. on the board. My co-host for the day, Matt Rothschild, formerly of the Progressive Magazine Wisconsin Democracy Campaign and friend of ours. Thank you, Matt, for joining us. The topic as of the moment, the Israeli-Hamas deal, a ceasefire, hostage exchange, and some of the additional reporting here. Now, Trump is also taking credit. So we heard some sound of Joe Biden taking credit. Trump's also taking credit. The Independent is reporting as such. The president-elect argued in a Truth Social post that the agreement expected to be formally confirmed later Wednesday could have only happened as a result of our historic victory in November. Another quote, a signal to the entire world that my administration would seek peace and negotiate deals to ensure the safety of all Americans and our allies. I'm thrilled American and Israeli hostages will be returning home to be reunited with their families and loved ones. Let's see a couple more of the quotes. The outgoing Biden administration described working tightly with the Trump team to seal the deal. Again, according to the reporting at The Independent, earlier this week, White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan told reporters that the Biden administration had coordinated very closely with the incoming Trump team to present a united message to all the parties, which says it is in the American national security interest, regardless of party, regardless of outgoing or incoming administration, to get this deal done as fast as possible.
Well, I'm glad they worked together to get it done, if that helped getting the thing done.
Right. I mean, ultimately, that's the point, right? Yeah.
And maybe Trump's got something there because, you know, he said, you know, if this thing isn't settled before I get in and, you know, the Gaza Strip is going to, all hell's going to break out.
All hell's going to break loose, right? Yes.
So, I mean, there is that too going on. But, you know, I'm still struck by the thing that you're struck by, Dom, which is this really going to lead to a grand solution where we don't have to deal with this problem every, you know, year, every 2 years, it blows up in our face or in the faces of the Palestinian people or the Israeli people. Because look at, you've got Governor Huckabee, who's going to be U.S. ambassador to Israel, who believes in a greater Israel, doesn't believe there is such a thing as the Palestinian people. You know, if the Palestinian people don't get a state of their own, there are going to be Palestinians, whether they're living in Palestine or not, who are going to be so outraged that, you know, their family's been, you know, dispersed and their uncles have been killed or their sons have been killed. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not going to give up this. They're going to be like, you know, Japanese after World War II or hiding out in the island still fighting the war. And is that something we want, especially with, you know, all sorts of weapons that are possible for people to get a hold of?
Yes. And again, it solves the immediate crisis, but it doesn't solve the problem. Right. And that's a concern. The New York Times has a headline, Matt: Gaza hostage deal could come as Trump takes office in echoes of 1981. The subheadline: dozens of American hostages held at the U.S. Embassy in Tehran for more than a year were freed just as Ronald Reagan was inaugurated.
Well, that suggests that that Trump was telling Netanyahu not to reach a deal while Biden was, or Kamala Harris was running for president.
Gosh, that sounds familiar.
That would be
the direct analogy.
That would be the analogy because as it's understood, as I understand history, one of the headwinds for Carter when he was negotiating and trying to get the hostages released was that the Reagan campaign behind their back, and I would say illegally, were also courting the Iranians and telling them that don't release the hostages until Reagan gets in. Because, of course, that would be a boost to the Carter administration right at the tail end of an election. And so if that were to be the case, and it seemingly history would indicate that the Reagan the Reagan campaign purposefully delayed the release of American hostages for political reasons. That is not what happened here. What happened here, according to the reporting, is that this was a framework set in place by the Biden administration dating back to May. As far as I know, the Trump campaign has not been in contact. There's no reporting with Netanyahu saying, don't do this. And apparently the Biden administration and the incoming Trump administration, at least the transition team, have been working together to show a unified face on this as it pertains to the United States national security, which I think is a positive thing. So I think that headline is a little misleading, Matt. I don't think it's analogous at all.
Well, unless they've got some information that the Trump folks were telling Netanyahu to drag his feet, and Netanyahu was dragging his feet. That's a fact. I mean, he would continually, you know, make last minute changes that would scuttle the agreement after May that looked like it was about to happen and never happened till now. But I don't have the facts behind that. I mean, it does make me raise an eyebrow and wonder whether it was happening. But, you know, I'm a trained journalist. I don't want to go off saying it happened when I don't have any facts that say it happened.
There's no indication that that was, in fact, the case. 855-752-4842. Let's get to it. CJ perhaps has a different opinion on this topic. Hey, CJ, welcome. What do you got for us?
Hey, Matt and Dom. Thanks for taking my call. Well, obviously, just broke pretty much everything down, but the irony that this has with the Carter administration with Iran and for 444 days tried to negotiate a release, and on the day of Ronald Reagan and peace through strength on his inauguration day, they were released because just like Ronald Reagan, Donald Trump is a man of his word. And he said, if you don't release them before I'm inaugurated, all hell will break loose. You've got the tape of that. I'm sure Jess can pull that up. And that was while Robert Lighthizer was standing next to him. And Biden claims for 8 months that he's negotiated this deal. Well, isn't it funny? You can look at the chronology. This is peace through strength and a Republican president. And it's now following the weakest president in America's history.
Okay, I'm going to stop you there, CJ. I'll let you go. Now allow me to retort, if I may, and Matt can jump in here as well. I just explained that why this is not the same, right? The Reagan campaign was secretly negotiating with Iran to not have the hostages released. Do you accept that as fact, CJ?
No.
Okay. No, okay. Well, then maybe you should do a little research on that, my friend. It was not about Ronald Reagan coming in and then all of a sudden the Iranians all being so scared. It was that Reagan was reaching out behind the current, behind the Carter administration's back to tell the Iranians to hang on to those hostages for political reasons to make Reagan look strong so people like you would believe that. So basically, Ronald Reagan negotiated with terrorists to keep American hostages hostage longer than they perhaps should have been. Is that new news to you, CJ?
You don't think that it was like the threat that he gave the Taliban when he handed him the
picture? I'm asking you, is that news to you, CJ? Is that new information for you about Ronald Reagan's dealing with the Iranian during the hostage crisis? Did you know that, CJ, or is that new to you?
October 7th.
So he didn't know that. Matt, what
I
do
mean,
you think?
My understanding is that Reagan sent his designee to be CIA director, William Casey, to talk to the Iranians prior to the election, tell them, you know, slow walk this thing. Don't make a deal with the Carter administration. And that was a treasonous thing to do. It was an illegal thing to do. No one has the right to negotiate for the United States other than the executive, the chief executive and his people. And you know, think of the hostages who had to stay there longer because of the shenanigans that Casey and Reagan were pulling just to make sure that they got elected. I mean, that was political tricks of the worst variety.
Of the worst kind. If it were to be analogous, it would be that Donald Trump would have delayed the release of this deal until after he was president. Like, you know, hey, make this happen on day one. Make it happen next week. Not during the Biden administration. But perhaps if the reporting is accurate and the Biden team and the Trump team were working in unison for this, great. I'm fine with that. You know, national security does not know politics. You know, our enemies are happy to see us at each other's throats, no doubt. But we're talking about national security. That's a national security for everyone. Now, that aside, and folks, you can join us as well, 855-752-4842. My concern, as I have articulated about this deal, it's a three-phase deal, 42 days, 42 days, 42 days. Time kills all deals. And the phase two and phase three, while there is an outline and has not yet officially been established. If someone like, and that won't be established, it will not happen before Monday. So if this, all you folks out there, all the megas out there that say, this is all because of Donald Trump's strength. Okay. You can have that. I disagree. I think it's a combination, at best, or primarily the current administration. But if you want to throw in the all hell will break loose threats, fine. Then ponder this. If phase two and phase three fall to the wayside, is that because of the weak leadership of Donald Trump? Are you going to take responsibility for those phases falling apart? Is that going to be Donald Trump's fault? Will that be his foreign policy blunders if phase two and phase three and 42 days and 42 days after that don't come to fruition? Are you megas, CJ, are you conservatives going to say that's Biden's fault or is that Trump's fault? You know what I mean? Who's taking responsibility?
And on the flip side, I mean, Biden does deserve credit for helping Israel deflect the Iranian incoming missiles.
Yeah.
And made Iran's military look bad. Netanyahu, and I hate to give him credit for anything, but he militarily did totally degrade not only Hamas, but Hezbollah. And so Hamas is in a totally weakened position here. And when you're in a weak position and, you know, you've got to at some point, you know, negotiate an end.
855-752-4842. Annie from Watertown, you will be next. Welcome, Annie. What do you got for us?
Yeah, that Iran thing, that was pretty well established by now. In fact, there was an election while the hostages were still there, and like 96% of the votes went for candidates that did back releasing them. And that was where the Iran-Contra and everything, Reagan's people, was it Casey, said, hold on to them, and we'll give you parts for you know, the American parts.
That was another Iranian, you know, that's amazing how the strong Republicans never deal with terrorists until they deal with terrorists.
It all started there, really. And now, even just recently in the past year or so, one of the guys on the plane to Iran came out. So, you know, there's no doubt about it anymore. But this deal with Hamas, Gaza, the Biden administration, of course, said there's going to be a transition here, you know. So he had somebody. He asked Trump to send somebody, and he sent a real estate guy. So Trump knew dang well that there had been an agreement approaching being, you know, settled on, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. That's why he could come out and say, oh, you know, make this big threat and then take the credit and make it look like. And people like CJ will just fall for that.
Good point. I mean, certainly, Matt, Trump saw the writing on the wall. They know there were ongoing negotiations. This has been going on for, you know, well over a year, at least back to May. So it's not a big stretch for someone like Donald Trump to make a claim like that in order to perhaps garner some credit for it.
Yeah, and let's be real. I mean, Trump, you know, claims credit for the sun coming up in the morning. Yeah. So that's just who he is.
Well, and that's the thing, though. If this deal, if phase two and phase three don't come around, that's going to be entirely under the Donald Trump administration. And hopefully that does happen. Hopefully we have a longer term solution where we're not back here in another 3 to 5 years talking about the next Israeli Hamas or whatever terrorist organization or organization will be, you know, claiming hostages at that point. I mean, things need to fundamentally change on the ground in people's minds and people's hearts. And people have a right to self-determination. Until that happens, I mean, how would you act? If you had the boot of somebody else on you all the time, regardless of what your father or grandfather may have been involved in, I know I'd be fighting back. Folks, this is the Dom Salvia Show. Join us 855-752-4842. Lots of texters, lots of callers. We'll get to you next.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Welcome back to the Dom Salvia Show, 855-752-4842. Earl Ingram joining us today. Got Jess on the board. You folks on the lines, 855-752-4842. All right. Well, let's take them. We got Mike Clemens. I thought we were going to do it later, but we got him on the line right now. Let's do it. Let's jump into it. We'll put off the Medicaid conversation for the next hour. Mike Clemens, sports reporter for Civic Media Radio. Appreciate you calling in, Mike. Welcome back. A sad day today, but a great day of reflection and memory of Bob Uecker, Mr. Baseball, passing away. Welcome, Mike. What are your thoughts?
Hey, Dom. I'm actually in the middle of a Zoom call with Mark Antanasio and his family. They're out in California, and they're talking about the fact that there was only a very tight circle in the Brewers organization that was aware that Bob Uecker had been dealing with something called small cell lung cancer since 2023.
Wow.
We did know about some heart surgery he had years ago. Mm-hmm. I remember also that, you know, he recently lost a daughter. I can't remember if that was ALS or something, so that was tough.
Yeah.
But he had battled pancreatic cancer and gotten through that. Pretty amazing. And
yeah, because pancreatic cancer is like the death now, man. I mean, if you get that, you come back from that, that's pretty amazing.
That's what Mark said. So he said just a few minutes ago, and it's still in progress right here, is that there were days last year where Uecker was going in for radiation and then going to the ballpark and calling a game.
Wow. I mean, just just the dedication. You know, we talked about the self-deprecating humor and, you know, in the Hollywood and doing the, you know, Johnny Carson, and he had the Mr. Belvedere show back in 85. He was on television. But he really, you know, he loved calling the games, man. And to my impression, it's going to be sad this summer, or, you know, this spring when we start playing baseball, and that voice is going to be missing from the air, Mike.
Yeah, and Jeff Levering and those guys do a great job of calling games, but there's no Bob Uecker, man. There isn't.
No,
you know, I mean, and Vince Scully was a great storyteller and knew baseball backwards and forwards, and, you know, did the games for 60 years and had a wonderful way of sort of writing the script every day. But Bob Uecker is one of the funniest guys ever, where even comedians like Norm MacDonald wanted to hang with the guy because he was just so darn funny. And he was really funny, you know, in person when he could just sort of be himself and let the words fly. And I'll, you know, there's a friend of mine who is on the Brewers staff and in the press box every single day. And of course, you know, Bob was getting older in the last couple of years. And so, you know, you're there in the restroom there off the press box, and there's Bob, and he sees him there kind of struggling. And so, you know, he doesn't want to embarrass him, but then he says, "Hey, you know, Bob, can I help you?" Because he's like struggling to get into one of the stalls or something. And Bob turns to him and says, "Yeah, sure. Hey, you want to hold it?"
I mean, and that, I mean, yeah, man, and the humor and the self-deprecating humor. I think, you know, I think of the beer commercials. You know, he was always the first guy to take a shot at himself.
He was, and well, that was his whole act, and it started with, you know, he's this baseball player for 6 years in the majors with the Braves, and the Cardinals, and the Phillies. In 64, he's with the Cardinals when they won a World Series.
Yeah.
But, you know, you get into and he said that he was a career 200 hitter, and he said, "Yeah, I had 3 or 4 RBI last year." He said, "You know," he said, "these guys that hit 330, you know, and hit 40 home runs, you know, They got nothing to look forward to the next year. How do you top that?"
Right.
I could always say I left some room to improve. So he's getting toward the ends of his baseball career. He started getting on the circuit as sort of a keynote speaker. Wasn't sure what he's going to do after baseball. And he's at this banquet and speaks. And one of the people at the banquet was Herb Al Hurt, the great New Orleans trumpet player.
Oh, yeah.
Had a song called Cotton Candy. He played in the first Super Bowl. He played on TV. Al Hurt. And Al went to him after he'd done his, you know, his stand-up for about 10 minutes at this banquet, said, "I'm telling you, I'm going to call some friends at the Tonight Show, and I'm going to get you on with Johnny Carson." And a couple weeks later, the Carson Show called him, and they booked him, and they put him on. And he did that. He did that act where he called himself, you know, Mr. Baseball, and he talked about how bad his career was. And then the crowd would laugh at him, and he would deadpan. He'd look like he was insulted,
yeah.
Right? And that's what made it even funnier. And so after he did a couple segments and Carson saw the guy just killed when he left, he leaned over to Ed McMahon and said, "Did that guy actually play baseball?" And Ed said, "Yeah, he was actually a baseball player." And that launched the career. Over 100 hits with Carson, then Mr. Belvedere, and then Major League, you know, just a bit outside.
So good. We played the cut earlier. What a career. What a life. And seemingly pretty private. You know, some of the stories, as I read the news today, I wasn't entirely aware of some of those things. And I don't know. I can't think of a bad thing to say about Bob Uecker, at least what we knew, what we saw, and the impact the guy had on baseball, certainly the state of Wisconsin. I mean, I don't know anybody, you know, we talk politics on the show here, Mike. I don't know anybody would have anything to say bad about Bob. Mike Clemens, Civic Media sports reporter. You only got like 45 seconds left, but I got to ask you, my mighty Lions playing the Commanders. Lions are favored by 9.5. Mike, what's your call?
Well, I don't do predict. I mean, the Bears just beat the Packers. You want me to make predictions? I mean, come on. But I think the Lions are an amazing team, and the Lions beat the Packers, the last team. Those teams, two teams met up by signing 4 guys off the street because they had so many injuries, and they still whooped the Packers. So, I mean, Dan Campbell and his staff have really got something going on.
Mike Clemens, if I heard you right, I think you're rooting for the Lions. Thank you, buddy, for making time for us today. Appreciate you. Folks, come back with us, 855-752-4842. Joe Biden's farewell speech coming up next.
the national news cycle never stops. But it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.